early on, I used to admire Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I even wrote on my t-shirts, Kareem. I used to write that on my t-shirt.
I love it.
And I knew I was going to play. I was going to do something. And never knew in my life that I was going to grow up and play with Kareem, be friends with Kareem.
Then you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Picks it off and there's number 23. And of course, Johnny goes nuts.
We're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Grant, you made the pass, yes. Christian, can you catch the ball, yes.
All the stars were aligned and all the muscles fired at the right time and I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 63. Thanks for joining me. Stay up to date with my monthly email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and much more. Simply visit inallairness.com/news. Today, I'm pleased to welcome 1982 NBA champion of the LA Lakers, Klay Johnson. We cover his whole career and also what he's been up to since retiring from basketball. It's a wide-ranging conversation that I'm sure you'll enjoy. Thanks, Klay, for the opportunity to chat. Towards the end of the episode, I'll also share another great podcast review. You can add yours by visiting inallairness.com/review. Show notes for this episode, including links to numerous topics we covered, are at inallairness.com/63. Now, onto the show. My guest today played for three seasons in the NBA. He won an NBA championship in 1982 as a member of the LA Lakers. He's a two-time junior college All-American and was a standout at the University of Missouri. Klay Johnson, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, based on what I can tell from my research, you were born in Mississippi. However, from high school onwards, your formative basketball life tends to center around the state of Missouri. When did basketball become your main focus growing up?
Well, basketball became my main focus on the playgrounds of the housing project that I lived in. Actually, I was born in Mississippi and left there when I was at the age of two. So I really know nothing about Mississippi. Only been there once since I was born.
Right.
So all I know is Kansas City, Missouri, really, as far as like living there. But basketball actually started on the project's playground. That's where it started.
And did you play other sports as well when you were growing up, or did you gravitate to basketball immediately?
Well, actually, basketball came at the latter part of my younger athletic career. I played baseball. I was a pitcher. Actually, I played in the All-Star game with a broken wrist. I played center field. And then from there, I played soccer. Played soccer for 3 years.
Do you enjoy playing soccer?
Oh, I love playing soccer. We had these two guys that come down to our housing project. We black guys growing up in the projects, and we had these two white guys. Actually, they came to our school and recruited us to play this game of soccer, which we knew nothing about. We all, the guys in my little group that we hung out with, we all enrolled and signed up for the soccer team. We knew nothing about soccer, but we figured, well, it's a game. You kick the ball. We could probably learn it. We all learned, and the first couple of years we played, we didn't win a game. We got killed, but we went out to the suburbs. That was our first really get away from the projects. We knew nothing past 15th Street, and we didn't know if there was a life past 15th Street. So these two white guys came and took us into places that we had never even dreamed of going to, which, later as we grew up, it was just only a couple of blocks away from our neighborhood.
Were you an attacking player, or did you spend most of your time in defense when you were playing on the soccer fields?
Oh, I played the right wing. I attribute soccer to a lot of my quickness and foot speed and probably my jumping ability. I attribute soccer to that, that develop all that, the athleticism. And, you have to really be a good athlete to play soccer. I give soccer all the credit for any basketball skills that I have.
Very interesting. So you mentioned soccer, you've talked about a bit of baseball as well, and then basketball more in your later years of childhood. What eventually got you to focus on basketball as the primary sport going forward?
Well, I used to watch the older guys play basketball at the community center. It was a group of older guys that when you're young, you watch the older guys play. They play on the playgrounds, and we had a recreation center that where they would play games at night. And we'd sit on the sideline watching the guys that we look up to playing basketball, you know, shooting jump shots and just playing. And so I always wanted to be like them, you know. It's like, wow. And basketball, you know, it was very competitive in the area where we grew up at. And I was just like, hey, I want to play. I want to be good at that, like the big guys.
Sure. So you're about 6'4"?
Yeah, 6'5".
At what age did you really start to grow into that frame? Were you quite tall as a young kid, or did that sort of come on throughout your high school years?
Actually, it came my freshman year. Between the freshman and sophomore year, I think I grew 3 inches, 3.5 inches that summer. We played freshman basketball. And then that summer, when we came back to school, the coaches looked at me and said, wow, you probably grew 5 inches. It was actually 3.5 inches just over the summer.
What position were you mostly accustomed to?
Well, actually a forward. See, my jumping ability developed early on. There was this guy that played on the varsity team. He could jump out the gym. And my freshman year, we had gym class together, and this guy, his name was Johnny B. Duncan. So high, and his thighs were just like monstrous. I would watch him jump and dunk, and in gym class, I would run around the whole hour trying to dunk the ball. And he spent some time with me and said, here's what you got to do. You're almost there. All you got to do is just turn the ball over at the right time. And I remember the first dunk that I finally dunked the ball, the whole gym class just went off because they say, oh, about time. You finally dunked the ball.
Oh, that's great. I love that sort of stuff. Is the name of your high school Manual? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Manual High School.
Okay, and that's in Kansas City?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So how good was the high school team when you were playing there at that time, Clay?
Well, the high school team, actually my freshman year, they went to state. And I think they won the state championship. And I was a freshman, so we didn't go, but our varsity team went. And I always, you know, I would look at those jerseys on the varsity players, and I was like, wow, I just can't wait. I can't wait to wear one of those jerseys, put on one of the varsity jerseys.
And did you know at that time that you wanted to pursue a career as long as you could in basketball? Was it that obvious at that stage that you really wanted to do that?
Yeah, it was early on. I used to admire Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I even wrote on my t-shirts, Clay Ream. I used to write that on my t-shirt.
I love it.
And I knew I was going to play. I was going to do something. And never knew in my life that I was going to grow up and play with Kareem, be friends with Kareem.
That's incredible, isn't it? We'll get to some of those experiences that you had playing alongside Kareem on the Lakers in a little while, but yeah, that's fascinating to hear. Now, I believe that you attended Metropolitan Community College in Missouri, playing for the Penn Valley Scouts for 2 seasons from 1974-75 and 75-76. And during that time, from what I can tell, you were a 2-time National Junior College All-American.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're still ranking the top 10 all-time for rebounds in a single season, and also rebounds in a career at almost 17 per game, which is outstanding. So do you mind just talking about your experiences playing with the Penn Valley Scouts? How was that?
Oh, that was incredible. Well, to back up on that story,
mm-hmm.
coming out of high school, I got to the point where I was tired of playing basketball.
Right.
I wasn't going to go to college at the time. I was tired. I don't like a lot of attention. I don't like the focus to be on me. And, you know, my high school career, everybody used to talk about me. Everybody used to talk about Clay Johnson and his jumping ability and how good he was. And I had these two buddies. They're my best friends. We've been friends since kindergarten. You see one, you see all three of us. I knew that once I went to the next level, if I was going to go to the next level, I couldn't be with my buddies. And so my high school coach would bring me letters every day, college letters. He'd bring these letters and give them to me from, you know, UCLA, Arizona, Florida State, you know, colleges from all across the country. He'd give me the letters and I take the letters and I throw them in the bottom of my locker. I wouldn't even open them. He found out that I was never following up with these letters, not opening them. And he came to me, he said, "What's going on?" I just told him, I said, "Coach, I'm not going to play basketball. I'm not going to go to school." And he looked at me, he said, "What? Have you lost your mind?" And I was like, "I'm not going to go." At the time, I had this girl that I was in love with, high school sweetheart. You know, I'm in love with her. My two best buddies I've been with all my life. All I was thinking about, if I go, I'm going to have to leave all this behind, leave them. So I just said to myself, "I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go." And my buddies, we had a plan. We were going to enroll in pipe fitting school. We were going to be plumbers.
Oh, okay.
So my coach heard that. He's like, you have really lost your mind. So he would come to me and every day he'd get letters. He'd still bring them to me. He would just throw them down at my foot, just throw them down on the ground. Like he was really like disgusted with me. I said I wasn't going to play. I wasn't going to go, but I still stayed. You know, I held on to what I was saying. You know, I thought, yeah, we actually had enrolled in plumbing and pipe fitting school. But then the Penn Valley Junior College, the coach, he heard that I wasn't going to school. And he persistent. You're talking about persistent. He came and he spoke with my mother almost every day. He would come by the house, talk with my mother. "Miss Johnson, we got to talk, Clay. We got to talk him into going to school." And she said, "Well, he's got his mind made up that he's not going to go." And he was persistent every day he'd come by. So he said, "Can we please talk Clay into going, please?" And so she had a talk with me one day and I just said, "Well, I'm just tired of all the attention and tired of everything, you know, being, you know, on me." And I was like, I just don't want to go. And she said, "Well, this man, he sees something in you. He just keep coming by here." She said, "Well, just talk to him. Just talk to him." Finally, I said, "Okay, I'll talk to him." So he sat down. We had a talk. He said, what is the problem? What is it?" And I just told him straight up. I said, "Well, you know, my buddies, I don't want to leave my buddies. I got this girlfriend." He said, "I'll tell you what, you know, your buddies are going to be here. Since you're going to be here in Kansas City," he said, just enroll in Penn Valley. Just enroll. And if you change your mind, you want to play, you know," I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. If you can get my two buddies a scholarship, I'll come."
Right.
"I'll play."
How did that work out?
It worked out. He gave them both scholarships. They played anyway. They were on a team in high school. It's not solely because of me that they were on the team. And I hate to think that, but he did give them scholarships and Pell grants. And, you know, they didn't have to pay for 2 years of school. And, you know, they would never say, "Well, the only reason why we went was because Clay went." You know, they'll say, "I went to Penn Valley because they were going." However the case is, you know, some 100 years later, we all went together. I went there and then that's where we ended up playing for 2 years. And then I, after 2 years of playing there, you know, I still excelled on the court and I started thinking a little bit. The letters start coming back in and I'm like, "Hey, what, me and the girl, we broke up. I'm growing a little bit in these 2 years." So I was like, "Hey, these chances are going to come back around now. The schools are calling again. The letters coming in." But now I'm looking at stuff a little bit different here. You know, I still don't want to leave my buddies. I'm realistic about the thing now. I know the 2 years that I was there, my buddies, they had attitudes like with the coach. They argued with the coach, but I never would let that affect me and my attitude. I kept a great attitude. Matter of fact, that's one of the things my coach would talk about more than my playing ability is the attitude and work ethic that I had on the court. Now, you know, I wouldn't let my friends influence me to act like they act. The schools start calling again. And then I said, "Well, I'm going to take some trips. I'm going to visit these schools. I think I'm going to go play some more after this."
before you ultimately decided to commit to coach Norm Stewart at Missouri, what other schools do you remember going to actually visit that you were quite interested in perhaps attending?
I had Indiana on the list. I was going to go to visit Indiana, but I would look at the stuff that Bobby Knight would do, his attitude, I mean, how he was with players. And I was like, oh, Lord, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to go to Indiana, you know, because I heard he beat the players and he was just, you know, mean and just crazy. So I was like, no, I won't go there. I didn't even take the visit. I went to visit a school called Quincy College. I went to a school called Southwest in Texas, Southwest. I can't even remember the name of it, Southwest something. And then I went to Florida and visited a school in Florida. I took a few visits, but I knew that I was just taking those visits. I wasn't going to go to those schools because they were a little too far away. So Missouri and Kansas were starting to recruit me. So it came down to Mizzou and KU. And I was like, okay, let me see. This is where it's going to be. It's going to be either Mizzou or KU. So the Kansas coach came, Ted Owens, and he was really stiff. He was stiff and just too formal. I was like, no. And then Coach Stewart came in and we laughed and we joked and we just had a good time. So I was like, okay, if it's going to be anything, it's going to be Mizzou. I'm going to go with Mizzou because Coach Stewart made me laugh. And so it came down to it and I chose Mizzou.
Well, you wanted to go somewhere that was going to make you comfortable, of course. So that makes sense that you'd choose that option. So really the persistence of the coach that you were talking about from the Penn Valley Scouts days and the fact that your mum sort of convinced you, I guess, to have a meeting with him led to your two outstanding seasons in the junior college system. And then that then led to these offers from other colleges. And then you eventually settled with Missouri and played your junior and senior seasons with them. It really changed the whole direction of your life without overstating things.
Yes, it changed the whole direction of my life. It changed my whole outlook on life. It was like I went from this, call it stupid thinking, to some reasonable thinking. It's like, well, you got to look at this. You got all this talent, all this ability. Why would you just give it up? You know, at least try to see what you can do. And then my 2 years at Missouri, you know, I said, well, I think I want to do this. I think I want to go pro. I want to play in the pros.
I love it. Now, in your junior season, which was the 1977 season, your team went 21-8, but you missed the NCAA tournament. I had a look through the record books last night before we started chatting today, and you had a career high with Missouri of 39 points against Colorado in January of 1977. Do you happen to recall that standout performance, and what did you make of that first season with the Tigers?
The first season with the Tigers, it started out not so good because Coach Stewart had told me, come on, you're going to start. Actually, they had a player, Willie Smith, was there the year before. He graduated the year before I got there. And Willie was Mr. Everything. He was all world, which was another reason why I ended up going to Mizzou, because Willie was just, he was all world, you know, to me. I was like, Willie Smith. And Coach Stewart came saying to me that he needed somebody to come step in to Willie's shoes and fill his spot, you know. So I was like, wow. I know there's no way I could fill his spot, but I could try. You know, I definitely tried. So I went there with the thoughts of, you know, he gonna let me play. Just let me go out there and just play and start. So I got there. It was kind of different story from what he told me. It was obviously that nobody could guard me on the team. You know, I was truly one of the better players on the team. Not taking anything away from the players that were there already, but talent wise and just athleticism and ability, you know, I was like, wow, you know. But the first couple of games, I sat on the bench and I go out and I play sparingly here and there. I was unhappy with that.
Mm-hmm.
We were coming to Kansas City to play in the Big Eight preseason tournament, and my family knew that I was unhappy. So I had expressed that to them, that I was unhappy that, hey, if I don't start playing, I wasn't going to sit there on the bench. I was going to transfer somewhere.
Okay.
So I told them that, and I think I had a talk with my mother, So just before we were going to the play in the tournament, the day before, actually, Coach Stewart called me to the office and he said, "Clay, I just want to let you know, we got these letters. We got about like 100,000 letters from people saying that you are going to transfer." And I was like, "What?" He said, "Yes, we got all these letters saying that you were going to transfer. You were unhappy." He said, "Is that true?" And I looked at him. I said, "Well, I'm be honest with you. I don't like sitting on the bench. I don't like, you know, not playing." I said, "But I didn't say I was going to transfer. I didn't really say I was going to transfer." He said, "Well, I just know we got all these letters coming from fans." He said, "Would they happen to come from your people?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know about that. They didn't tell me about that." I said, "But could have been. It could have came from them." He laughed about it. And like I say, we laughed about it. He said, I'll tell you what, Clay. He said, "I'm trying to work something out here." He said, "You just bear with me. Just bear with me. I know we're going to Kansas City. I know we're going to go to your hometown." He said, "I probably won't start you, but you're going to play a lot. I'm going to let you play a lot." He said, "This is when I'm going to make the turn to you playing. You know," he said, just be patient with me. Just be patient." And I just looked at him and I was like, you know, still not really convinced.
Yeah.
So when we got to Kansas City, I didn't start, which was very hard coming home in front of all your people, all your friends, and to not start after being all everything, you know, at home. But, you know, I got to sit on the bench. So still trying to keep my good attitude. It was really hard to keep the good attitude at this point. So I played a whole lot that game. So after the game was over, Coach Stewart came to me as I was walking out of the dressing room. He just looked at me. He said, "What you think?" I was just kind of nodded at him. He said, "So you going to stay?" And I said, "I'm staying."
Good choice. Good choice.
Yeah.
So you could see that there'd be some more minutes coming your way and you'd get a more regular opportunity to take part on the court.
Yeah. And matter of games, a couple of games I was starting. So he worked it out.
Do you happen to remember that game that you lit it up for almost 40 points when you were playing against Colorado?
Yeah, I remember that game because there's something that helps me remember that game. My mother's house had just burned. Well, my house where I live had just caught on fire the day before. And I was going to go home, you know, to go look after my mother and see what was going on. You know, I had to be there because my mother and father weren't together. So I was like the man of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to go home and one of the alumni called me. He said, "Clay, I want you to know we got your mother. We're going to take care of her. We're looking after her. So, your mother told me to tell you, don't worry about coming home. You go ahead and play. Go play that game." And I was like, "You sure?" I was like, "No, I got to be there for my mother." He said, "No, we're supposed to assure you that everything's going to be all right." So he said, "You just go out there and play." And I said, "Okay." So I went out that night. I may have had like 7 dunks and I went 11-11 from the free throw line. It was just a crazy game. I didn't think nothing about the house being burned while the game was going on. I was just out there having fun.
Yeah, well, you had 39 points, and that was a career high at Missouri there for you. So obviously a fantastic effort once you knew that your mum was okay and she assured you that things are all right. Now, just moving on to your senior season at Missouri for 1978, the team actually had a losing record. However, even though that was the case and you had 7 less wins than the season before, you did make the NCAA tournament on the strength of winning the Big 8 postseason tournament. And in that tournament itself, you hit a game winner at the buzzer.
Right.
I found a great description of the final moments of that game. So I'll just quickly read this out to you and I'd love to get your take on what actually took place. So it says, with the score tied at 63, with less than a minute to play, and with a ball in Larry Drew's hands, Missouri played for one shot. As time ticked away, Drew found Clay Johnson on the baseline. The high-flying senior elevated and drilled a jump shot. By the time Johnson's feet hit the floor, the Tigers were in the second round. So that was from late February in 1978, and you won by 2 points. So what memories do you have of that game winner there, Clay?
Well, I'm not known as the jump shot shooter. I was never known as the one with a jump shot. And that's just because of my jumping ability and my quickness. And my first step was I go around somebody in a minute, and I never really worked on, say, the mechanics of the jump shot.
Right.
So that game there, I was like, wow, I can shoot. And Coach Stewart was like, it's designed for me to take it and go to the hole and dunk it. But I stopped and shot a jump shot. And Coach Stewart said it just the way we planned it.
And that was the Big Eight postseason tournament that you were playing in at that time, which your team went on to win, which gave you the berth into the NCAA tournament. Unfortunately, you got ousted in a two overtime first round loss against Utah, but you had a fantastic game personally, scoring 30 points in what was your final college game. So how was the atmosphere of that appearance in the NCAA tournament and concluding a great couple of seasons there with Missouri?
Yeah, well, this was my first really showing in the tournament, the NCAA tournament, because my senior year we didn't get a berth. We actually should have, but we didn't get it. They asked us to go to the other tournament,
the NIT,
but Coach Stewart declined. He declined that offer. And I wanted to go, but he was like, "No, if it's not the NCAA, we're not going." And I was like, "Wow, why not?" So the next year, we 14-15 going into the tournament. We drew Utah. And my thing about Utah, they had a guy on the team. I think his name was Jeff Judkins. And there was so much talk about Jeff Judkins. He's an All-American prospect. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. And I was like, I love to be the underdog. It's like, don't ever underestimate me. I think he may have scored 7 points or something like that. I can remember it wasn't many, but we were up going down the last 2 minutes of the game. I think our center that we had, he just kind of like flipped out. You know, we were in kind of like a delay game, and he take it up on himself to take the ball to the hole and miss the layup. And we just eventually like lost the game. It's like, wow, we went to double overtime, but I wanted to win that game so bad. All I was thinking about, this could be my last college game. I don't ever want this to end. So I was like, we got to win this game. Everybody on our team thought we were going to win the game. I don't even think I came out of the game at all the whole game.
Do you feel tiredness at all during those sort of moments, or does the adrenaline just kick in?
I never got tired that game. I could have won another overtime. I just never got tired.
Because it went to double overtime, as you said, and you're right. I did read in the research for this chat that you were up, I think maybe 63-55 or something like that late into the game as well. And then unfortunately over those two overtime periods, Utah came away with the victory. So that was, would have been a devastating loss, I guess, going so close to being able to make it further into the most prominent, you know, NCAA tournament.
Right. And then you never want to blame anybody for the heat of the moment. You don't want to say, Stan, if you had just not shot the ball, we lost the game. We lost it together. You know, everybody lost the game. So I don't think a game ever should come down to one moment where you can pin it on one person. Where if you had to hit that last shot, we would have won. No, it should never come down to a last shot. Like I said, you know, college was over. It was a really hurting thing.
Now, as a senior, you were named to the All Big Eight team. And then in the 2 years with the Tigers, you averaged better than 15 points and almost 8 rebounds a game, which are great achievements. Reflecting back on your college career, what do you remember most fondly?
Well, I just remember all the competition, actually just playing major college basketball. I knew it was going to be tough, but my frame, I'm like skinny, real thin. And I remember everybody always talking about Clay, so strong. He's thin, but he is so strong. I would guard some of the forwards, the real power forwards. I would never back down from anybody. And that's one thing I remember. And we played against Marquette Warriors. That's the one game that sticks out in my mind. Marquette came into Columbia, and they were the national champs the following year. And they came in late, and they didn't even warm up much. And I said, okay, we're going to beat them. We're going to beat this team. And we were up again, up on them, and ended up losing. But I didn't feel as bad because they were the national champions. I got this picture of me. All five Marquette players are jumping. It was a tip dunk. I'm right in the center, all the players, and all you see is my throw, my hand on the ball, straight up in the air, and I tip dunked it. I tip dunked the ball. I was like way above the rim. I think my face was like looking down in the rim. It's the gym just got silent when I dunked it. It's a perfect picture. I got all of them with their hands on the rim. Some kind of way they around me and I'm in the center. All you see is my back and my fro.
Love it. That's great. It's good to have memories like that as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, after your college career had come to an end, do you recall your whereabouts in the lead up to the 1978 NBA draft? Like, were you being scouted by some pro teams, or what was actually happening at that time before the draft rolled around?
I had an agent, a guy out of Arizona, and he was really excited about me coming on his team because he was telling me that, you know, from his research, that he was getting back feedback. He was getting back from all the general managers and that I was going to go late first round, early second. You know, he didn't say what team. He said the San Antonio Spurs was looking at me. And I was like, well, okay. I was happy about that. But they'll tell you this stuff, but you never know. But I was excited going into the draft. Actually, my second semester in my senior year, I actually did enough to be eligible. I kind of quit school because all I was thinking was the pros. Larry Drew was my roommate and a couple other guys. And, you know, they start trying to take on the habits I had sleeping in. And I say, no, you guys got to go to school. You got two more years up here. You can't do like I do.
You mentioned Larry Drew there. His freshman and sophomore seasons would have been your junior and senior seasons, if I've got that right.
Yes, right.
Obviously a very formidable backcourt, yourself and Larry Drew, when you were playing the guards. At that time, did you sense that Larry was going to have a lengthy NBA career?
I really didn't. I didn't sense that. I mean, I knew he was a great passer. I didn't sense that he was going to be in the pros that long, but, you know, I knew he was a great player.
Mm.
But I guess I never knew enough about pro basketball and how it works, but. I just knew that I was going to have the long career, you know, but it didn't turn out that way. So I'm happy with the way mine turned out, all in all.
Not too many people can say they have an NBA championship ring, and we'll get to that pretty shortly. June the 9th in 1978 was NBA draft day, and you were selected by the Portland Trailblazers with pick number 110 in the fifth round. And Portland also had the number one pick overall, and they chose Michael Thompson from the University of Minnesota. Now, how did you first learn that the Blazers had selected you? Because back in this time, it's pretty much conference calls and things like that. I don't think it was televised on TV until into the 1980s, was it?
Right, it wasn't. They actually called. They gave me a call. I got up early that morning, you know, preparing for the draft. My agent told me, he said, get up. You know, you want to get with your family and you should get a call on the first round, early second. And I was like, okay. So I'm sitting down. The draft is going on. I think we listening to it. We know it's going on some kind of way. And I didn't get a call early. I was like, So I called my agent. I said, well, so what's going on? He said, well, you didn't go in the first. And the second went past. And the third went past. And the fourth. And now I'm starting to get like, down on myself. I'm like, oh man, wow. I'm not going to even get drafted. So then I got a call from Stu Emmon from the Portland Trailblazers. He said, let me know. Well, we selected you as in the fifth round, Portland Trailblazers. So my family, they were all jumping up and down. They were happy. And I was like, I was disappointed, you know, to go in the fifth round. I was very disappointed, but you know, I had to play it off and be excited for my family because at least I did get drafted.
Portland were only one full season removed from having won the 1977 NBA Finals, and the coach was the legendary Dr. Jack Ramsey. So you were with the team for a little over 4 months, from what I can tell, before, according to basketballreference.com, the team waived you in October of that year. I did read about some strong performances that you had in the Summer Pro League, and then a late September exhibition game where you played at Seattle when a few of the veterans on your squad were sidelined with injuries when the training camp was coming to an end. Now, do you remember any of those games that you played with Portland before leaving the team?
Well, like you said, in the summer league, I was just looking at some of my old stats. I still have some of the old stat sheets
mm-hmm.
From my Portland days. I started and I averaged like 25 points in the summer league. I mean, I was like unstoppable in the summer league. And then I got invited back to veterans camp, and I said to myself that, you know, okay, I win the fifth round. Now I got to show them. I got to show them that I'm a first round draft choice.
Mm-hmm.
I came to camp after we went to summer league and came back home. I said, it's time for me to go to work. And so I was running, lifting weights in the gym every day for about 8 hours a day, just constantly, constantly. And there was this old guy at the gym. He's like, what are you doing? What do you work out for like this? I said, I'm going to make this basketball team. He's like, oh, really? He said, you're gonna make it too. You're gonna make it because you putting in work. And then when I got to camp, the first day at camp, there was this guy that worked with the Trailblazers. I don't know what his position was. Dr. Ogilvy, I remember his name, but he dealt with psychological part of with the players. He came to me. He said, every year I pick the person that's gonna make the team. He said, I'm picking you. He said, you are prepared. You ready. I'm picking you. You are my pick to make the team this year. And I was like, wow. He said, every year, and I've never been wrong. That was instant pressure on me, you know.
Yeah, well, that's true. That is true. So
yeah.
Did you have a feeling that as the training camp had come to an end and it's getting close to the start of the regular season that your time was coming to an end, or did you believe that you were going to be part of the roster going forwards? Like, how did you feel at the time that you learnt, at least for that period of time, that you'd have to wait for another opportunity to get back into the NBA?
Well, I kind of felt like, okay, here's the deal. I started the first four preseason games at small forward. There was articles, Stu Lemon was talking about, they've been watching me for my whole career, and you know, at Mizzou, and they knew what I can do, and that's the reason why they drafted me, and they were not surprised at my performance in camp and what I was doing. They was like, we already knew this about him. I guess they had to make themselves look good. I don't think they really knew it, but you know, I came to camp in shape, and you know, I was like, I was trying to make a name. I said, they're gonna know who I am, you know, when I leave this camp. But my problem was in the games, I could not relax. You know, I get out there on the court playing against Adrian Dantley, David Thompson, you know, these players. And I was like, I get starstruck out there on the court. Instead of just focusing on what I need to do, I was looking at them like, wow, I'm actually out here on the court playing against these players, superstars. And so I would have a wide open layup and miss the layup. Just couldn't hit a shot. My nerves were just shot. So, you know, all the other reserve players, the other draft choices, they was like, Clay, man, you in there. You ain't got to worry about getting cut. You in here. You going to make this team. Deep down inside of me, I knew that I blew it. I knew I blew it. If I had had a decent game, one decent game, I would have made it.
That must have been a very tough pill to swallow there. And it's understandable that you can get put off by the fact that you're playing against some of these greats of the 1970s and into the 1980s as well. So going up against them, of course, would have certainly tested out your wherewithal. Now, please correct my timeline if I'm not quite accurate here, but from what I can tell, after leaving the Blazers, you then played in the Continental Basketball Association while you were trying to hope to redeem yourself with another NBA opportunity. And you played for two or three seasons in the CBA with teams that included the wonderfully named Hawaii Volcanoes. And then later, I think the Billings Volcanoes of Montana. Do you mind just talking about that period of your career in the CBA and how was that experience, knowing all that time you were hoping to get another shot at the NBA?
Okay, the first team I played for coming out of Portland was a team in Salt Lake City called the Utah Pros.
Right.
This team, it was a league had just formed called the Western Basketball Association.
Okay.
I think there were like seven teams in the WBA. The owner of the team, he followed me. They chose me as their first round draft choice. So I did still end up, I was the first round draft choice that year.
Good.
Yeah, I still was a first round draft choice, but I was like out of the rejects though.
I wouldn't put it that way, but I didn't actually know about that WBA. So was that a short lived league, or did that then sort of pale behind the CBA?
It actually lasted 1 year.
Right.
It was really the way it was put together, it was really nice. The way we flew places, we flew everywhere. I think there was Reno, there was Las Vegas, there was a team in maybe Wyoming, Salt Lake City, Fresno. It was like 17.
Okay.
In that league. Tucson, the Tucson Gunners. I mean, it was a good league. A lot of the players that were in the league had been in camps, NBA camps, and we get together and we have our little stories about, you know, why we got cut, how long they said that they're going to be before they bring us back, and you know, like that. Everybody's talking, they're going to bring me back. They said the only reason why they let me go was because of this, and you know, but I was like, no, I got cut. No, I got cut. They're not talking about bringing me back. But Jack Ramsey did tell me that he wanted me to go to Salt Lake City and play because he said, I know you can play in this league. You just need a little bit more fine tuning. So I took that and I went with Jack McKinney too. He was actually my coach out in the summer league. Jack McKinney was.
All right. And when you were with the Blazers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think, you know, eventually that was probably my connection because, you know, he coached the Lakers too.
Yeah.
That was my real connect with the Lakers, because of him. Because the way I played out there. The WBA was the stepping stone, you know.
Speaking of McKinney, Paul Westhead would obviously inherit the Lakers squad following McKinney's terrible accident. We'll get to that shortly as well. But in August of 1981, from what I can tell on the timeline here, you then signed as a free agent with the LA Lakers.
Mm-hmm.
When did you become aware that there was a strong possibility that you'd be rejoining the NBA?
Actually, I was in training camp with the Lakers the beginning of that year.
Okay.
I was in training camp, and I had one of the best camps that I ever had. I've been to a couple of camps then, but that year I should have been on the Laker team to start with. I played in the summer league with the Lakers that prior year. I was in the summer league, and actually Pat Riley was the coach of the summer league team.
Okay, right.
This was actually my second real successful summer league with the Lakers. I mean, I'm really humble, really modest and stuff, but I tore the summer league up. I tore it up. And that's when me and Mike McGee, we were on the same team in summer league. And we just, you know, between the two of us, I think I made an average 30 and he probably averaged 25. And this was every game. I could do whatever I want to do out in the summer league. And then Pat Riley, I remember one time he pulled me to the side. He's like, Clay, I want you to know that a lot of people are looking at you. You turning a lot of heads out here. He said, but we have you. We have you on our team. I got you. And he just wants to say, he said, I want to tell you, you're a fixture with this team. And I was like, wow, fixture. But I guess it wasn't his ultimate decision, you know. I came back to veterans camp. I had a good camp. I had a real good camp. The little story I like to tell about that on the day that they were going to make the final cut. I had been cut before, so I know this is the day that they tell everybody we're going to make the final cuts today. Practice was over with. They called practice, but you could see them calling different players over to the side to give them their little speech about the reason why they got to cut you. So we all kind of shooting around and they calling everybody, and I'm looking around. I said, wow, they haven't called me yet. So I said, well, maybe I may have made. I know I played well enough to have made this team. So let me stop thinking negative. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go get my bag and I'm going to the door and go out to my car and go back to the hotel room because I know I got this team made. And all the time I'm taking steps, looking around like, I'm getting close to the door. So I said, okay, about 10 steps from that door. If I make it to that door, I'm going to be good. So I'm looking around. As I get to the door, I slow down a little bit just to kind of hesitate. And I was like, I still didn't get a call. Nobody called me. So I was like, oh, wow, I'll make it outside the door. I'm good. Went outside the door, walked to the hallway, actually got to the car, reached for the door handle, get ready, open the door. And I heard, Clay. So I turned around. I said, shit. Coach Westhead, he's calling me, Clay. I was like, whew. So I turned around, came back. I said, okay, I know what you're going to tell me. I know what you're going to say. Okay, give it to me. He said, well, I want you to know that you are a hell of a player. He said, we have too many players your height, like Michael Cooper being 6'5", Jamal Wilf being 6'8". He said, if you were 6'8 or 6'1", he said, you would own this league. And I'm looking at him like, what sense does that make? If I was 6'8", if I was 6'1", you would own this league. And I'm like looking at him like, yeah, you just have to tell me something. I'm giving him that look.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm looking at him. He said, but we gotta, we have to let you go. I want you to keep trying. I want you to keep at it though. Keep at it. So I'm looking at him like, I wanted to tell him, call him everything, but the child of God. Cause I'm like, I know I played well enough to be on this team. There was no nervousness. There was nothing. I played. So I just said, thanks, coach. I want to thank you, for everything that you've done. And thank you for the opportunity. So I got back in the car and I hit the steering wheel. I said, damn, I had this one. I said, oh, well, I'm not going to be mad. Keep plugging. So I went back to Montana and, I got a call a couple of weeks later from Jerry West. He told me, he said, Clay, we all think that you play well enough to be on this team. Everybody except Paul Westhead. He said he was the only one that was, not for you making the team. But he said, I want you to just be patient. Just hold on. He said, we're going to make some changes up here. If you remember, that's the year that Magic was, unhappy with the style of play that they were playing.
Yeah, definitely.
And he was talking about he wanted to be traded. They said, well, just hold on. Then they announced the firing of Paul Westhead. Jerry West said, we're going to work something out to get you back up here. And I was just like happy. I was waiting. It took a little longer for them to work out, something to bring me back. But actually the team I was playing for in Montana, we were playing for the championship in Eastern Pennsylvania. We were playing against a team back there in the championship. And then that's when I got the call. I kept telling my teammates, I was like, I'm going back to NBA this year, y'all. They're going to call me. And we were down to the last couple of games and I still was saying, I'm going back. My then roommate, he said, Clay, man, you might as well just face the fact. You're not going, man. He said, we playing for the championship. Our season almost over with. And I said, I'm still going. And I got a call that first road trip, the first game of the championship series.
At that point, then you had to leave Montana, and then that's when you started playing in the NBA regular season.
Right.
On basketballreference.com, on your game log, it looks like your first regular season game was April the 4th in 1982, which was almost 4 years since the Blazers drafted you. And as fate would have it, your Lakers then hosted the Portland Trailblazers of all teams.
Right.
Do you actually remember those feelings that you experienced in that first game that you actually got to take to the court, Clay?
Yes, I do remember that. I remember that quite well. It's because it was against the Portland Trail Blazers. I was like, you know what? It's just funny how things work.
Mm.
I said, the Portland Trail Blazers cut me, and then I come back and make my debut, my first NBA game against the Portland Trail Blazers. And I was just like, wow. And then I actually got a chance to play in the game, too. They gave me some time, and I had on some red Converse, because my team back in Billings, we wore red, and I brought my team's tennis shoes back with me, and I didn't even have purple yet. So I had on some red Converse. Well, they were white with red trim, playing against the Trailblazers, and I was just so glad that was a team that I got drafted by who cut me, and I ended up playing my first game against them.
Yeah, it shows you what persistence will do, and having that dream that you're going to make it back to the league. So I'm sure that would have been fantastic for you. You were mentioned and quoted in Jeff Perlman's excellent book that came out last year titled Showtime. You talked about a dislike of Paul Westhead as the coach, as did numerous players. After a 7-4 start to what would be your first NBA season, Westhead was replaced by the very famous Pat Riley, of course. Do you mind just talking a little bit about your opinion on Westhead? You mentioned that he was the only guy that wasn't for you at that time, perhaps. And then the contrast in having Pat Riley as your head coach when you took to the court later in 1982.
Yeah, well, Pat Riley, I always gave him a lot of respect. He dealt with a lot of the mental part of basketball and just of life. He gave me some insight to stuff that, I was like, wow, Because I remember him kind of like taking me under his wings, and you know, when they would call timeout or whatever, when Westhead was there, Pat Riley would always get close to me and, you know, kind of like put his hand on me, touch me, you know, and some kind of just like, as to say, okay, just be calm, you know, just be careful. And I just gave him so much respect. And Westhead, I just had a feeling that he didn't know what he was doing to me. I always had that feeling that not really giving him a lot of respect for being a head coach in the NBA. It's like, okay, some people really earn the right to be a head coach, but I just felt like, to me, he didn't know what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for these players, you know, he wouldn't be there. And I looked at McKinney was actually the head coach, and he just happened to be in the position when Ken McKinney got hurt, and he just kind of like, I could have won the championship, you know, because McKinney had already set the stage.
It was an incredible series of circumstances that actually led to Westhead taking over the team following that terrible accident of McKinney, and I had no idea of any of that sort of stuff had happened behind the scenes. So reading Jeff Perlman's book, I learned a lot about that incredible franchise that Lakers had, especially during the 1980s, and you were a part of that. And then in 1982, you won the NBA championship with the Lakers in a six-game series against the Philadelphia 76ers. 30-plus years later, what are your strongest memories of being a part of that championship team and just soaking in the atmosphere of the forum and ultimately winning that NBA championship?
Well, the thing that really stands out with that team was the confidence that team had, that we had. I recall several times if we were having a bad game, if we were behind any given moment, you know, we'd call a timeout and team would come over just confidently, and the confidence was just oozing out of their pores. They look at each other, okay, it's time to play. And they say, okay, well, here we go. Let's go out here. And Pat Riley would draw up a play. We come out of the timeout, go out there and score a bucket. And that one bucket lead to another bucket. And the Magic would start high five. Kareem throw the sky hook. And then we'd be up 20. And then we, the substitutes, we would look at each other. Well, it's time to start getting loose. We get ready to get in the game.
Love it. So good. So you mentioned Kareem earlier on at the start of our chat, how you looked up to him when you were growing up and you had your Clay Ream t-shirt and all that sort of stuff. So what was it actually like being teammates, being in the locker room, just being friends with these guys, either on or off the court? You know, you're playing with some of the all-time greats of the game. Magic Johnson, of course, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, James Worthy. The list just goes on. Do you mind just talking a little bit about sharing such a great experience with some of these all-time greats?
Okay, well, when I first met Magic, it was a media day. The first time I got with the Lakers, it was media day, and we were all rookies and free agents trying to make the team, and then all of a sudden, here come the veterans in for media day.
Mm-hmm.
Magic walks up to me and he looks at the back of my jersey and it said, C. Johnson. And he said, it can only be one Johnson on this team. And I looked at him.
Wow.
And I was like, well. Then I said to myself, he don't know who he's messing with. Because I looked at it this way, that they thought I was a rookie, you know, like a fresh out of college type rookie.
Mm-hmm.
I was saying to myself, I'm not a rookie, like in that sense of it. Sure, you know, I haven't played a game in the NBA, but I've been playing 3 years in the CBA, and I've been in Portland. I've been on the court. It's like, they don't know who I am. So I said to myself, okay, I got to show him. I have to show him who I am. And so the first day in camp, I dunked everything. I was dunking everything. And so that first day, they knew who I was after that.
I love that.
That was my experience with him. Then we end up, you know, like right now, we the best of friends. So, you know, just him not knowing who I was, like, okay, I have to show him. And then with Worthy ended up being my best friend on the team. We were just buddies. And Kareem, he has all the respect in the world for me because we were buddies. We would go eat lunch together. And then people always say, well, how was it playing with that team? It was like, you can't describe it. But while I was there, I didn't look at it like that because everybody was like brothers on the team. We were inseparable. when we go to a different city, we get eight strong, seven, eight of, we go to the movies together. We go to the clubs together. We did everything together, go eat together. I think that's one of the things that the glue that really kept us together, because we had each other's back. We knew on the road we were like family. It was like a family.
Very strong unit. So that's great to hear from someone who was part of that team. And I should add, in games 3, 4, and 5 of the 1982 NBA Finals, you got some court time as well. What was it like actually having that Forum crowd on your side cheering you guys on as you were heading towards the closing games of the series?
It was amazing. I remember one game, actually, I got first half action. We were actually kind of struggling a little bit, and I came out there and I was playing defense, and Dr. J, he actually threw a cross-court pass, and I cheated. No, our press was out of this world. I knocked the ball down, intercepted the ball, and it seemed like I took one dribble and took off from half court and dunked it.
I think I might have actually seen that play on YouTube. You're going to the right of screen, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Nice dunk too.
Norm Nixon says to this day, Clay, that's the coldest dunk I ever seen. You know, because he was right there. We were down, and you know, a couple plays here, a couple plays there. You know, the little spark I gave that ended up turning the game around, and we won that game. So,
if it's the same dunk that I'm thinking of, it was a nice strong dunk going to the right of screen. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes to this episode as well for the listener. They can go check that out and see the actual highlight of the play that is in question.
Yeah, Maurice Cheeks was the guy chasing me, and they was talking about how fast he was. And another thing I want to say about being fast, they said Norm Nixon was the fastest player in the NBA when I was playing. But every time at the end of practice, when we run the sprints, Kareem would always get up and say, I got my money on Clay. I got my money on Clay. And I would smoke Norm Nixon every time.
It's always good to have Kareem on your side. So that's a bit of extra motivation.
Right. So I tend to differ who's the fastest player in the NBA back then.
That's great. I love those sort of stories. Now, moving into the 1983 NBA season, two of your top three scoring performances whilst you're in the NBA were against the Kansas City Kings. You scored 13 points apiece in a back-to-back home-and-home series in early February of 83. Now, am I putting words into your mouth, or did you take added levels of motivation into games with Kansas City, particularly given your strong links to that city?
Not really, but I guess I don't know if Pat Riley knew that was my hometown, and he just kind of let me go.
Mm-hmm.
I was instrumental in us winning one of those games because I think I scored all those points in a short period of time. And you know, a couple of dunks here, a couple of dunks there. And we came back and we won the game. So then everybody would ask me, do you take it personal against the Kings because you're from Kansas City? It's like, no, not really. This is just where Pat Riley let me have the most time.
Okay. Yeah, well, that I was curious about because I wasn't sure, given your obviously strong links to that area, that you might have taken it upon yourself to try and have that as extra motivation, but just the way circumstance played out. And also, just by chance, in those games between Kansas City and LA, I looked at the basketballreference.com box score of those games, and there was 5 players that had Johnson as their surname. You had Eddie Johnson, Steve Johnson, Reggie Johnson for Kansas City, and then you had Magic Johnson and, of course, yourself, Clay Johnson. So 5 Johnsons on one court.
Right, yeah.
Just by coincidence. Just moving on, in November of 1983, the Lakers waived you, and then about a month later, you signed as a free agent with Seattle. Were you aware in the interim that the Sonics were one of the teams that were looking to perhaps sign you?
It was completely shocked to me because I, again, coming off of a good camp, I knew that I should have stayed in L.A. I should have been there.
Mm.
But I guess they saw differently. I actually went to Florida, Sarasota, Florida. They had a team in the CBA.
Okay.
I went there, and it just so happened that the coach that was coaching that team, I was like, Lord, if I don't get picked up soon, I'm not going to be able to stay here because the coach was crazy, you know. But I stayed down there I think I was down there 2 weeks, and then Seattle called and signed me. And I was so glad of that.
Yeah, right. Okay. Just going back for a minute to when you said that you were with Montana and then got to play with the Lakers. Did Montana end up winning that championship in that season?
I think they lost.
They lost. Okay. Just curious while I think about it. Now, with the Sonics, you played 28 games in total throughout the 1983-84 season. Your final game was game 4 of the Sonics playoff series against the Dallas Mavericks in late April of 84. Did you have a sense at that stage that that would be your last chance at the NBA, or did you have every intention of then hoping to stay with the team at that time? How did that sort of come to an end in terms of your NBA playing days?
Well, I was hoping that I would sign with the Sonics again and play a couple of years with them, looking at the guards that they had on the team. And some of the players agree with me, you know, as far as the guard skill set. They had Al Wood, John Stumbold, which are all great players, good players, but I should have been there. They should have kept me on that team, asked me if I would go to the summer league. And at this point, I'm thinking, I'm experienced veteran, I shouldn't have to go to the summer league and play with the rookies that are trying to make team. I kind of questioned that, but I went out there anyway. In the first 2 games, they didn't even play me. And I'm thinking, like, well, what's going on? I've seen this done before. I see how they do this. And so I went to the assistant coach that was coaching the team. And I said, what's going on? I said, do you all plan on keeping me or what? He said, well, you probably need to talk to Coach Lenny Wilkins on that. So I called Lenny, and I was like, okay, I kind of see what's going on. What's going on? Are y'all planning on keeping me or what? And at this point, I'm getting fed up with spending my time, you know, something that I know is not going to lead to anything. So I just said, well, if you guys are going to keep me, then sign me. Give me a year guarantee, and I'll stay out here in the summer league. He said, well, Clay, we can't do that right now because of something. And I was just like, okay. I cut him off. I was like, can somebody send me a plane ticket home because I'm going home? And he was like, what? I said, yeah, I'm going home because I see what's going on. So he called my mother right after that and said, Miss Johnson, you know, I want you to know that Clay elected to go home. Can you talk to him and staying out here? And I'd already talked to her and told her what was going on. I was like, they're not going to do this again to me. They're not going to cut me. I'm going to be the one to say I walked away from it. So I went home. That was it. That was it. So I ended up playing with Kansas City. Had a team called the Kansas City Sizzlers in the CBA. And they heard that I was at home. And it's like, well, you know, do you want to play on this team? And I was like, I'm finished. So they ended up talking me into playing, you know, on that team. And they stayed in Kansas City 1 year. And then the next year they moved to Topeka. And they wanted me to play on the home games. And I was like, I'm done. That's when I called it quits.
So what did you make of that? I think it was the 85-86 CBA season. And the team went 25-23, if the records are accurate, that I looked at online. What did you make of that time with the Sizzlers and playing in front of a crowd that was very familiar with your basketball prowess? Or at that stage, were you just, as you're sort of indicating, pretty much done with the game at the level that you were playing?
Well, it was still fun, and the NBA teams were still talking. Just about every game, we had some type of scout there. San Antonio Spurs, the San Diego Clippers. Almost each game, there was talks about they coming to look at you, Clay. They coming to look at you. And my thing was, what do they want to see? What do they want to see at this point? They know my style of play. They know defense. They know I could jump, and I'm doing all that. So I got to the point where I didn't even care if the scouts was in the stands. I was like, the NBA is full of it. They're not looking at me. You know, who are they really looking at? I just gave up hope on that. I was just playing to have fun, you know, in the back of my mind thinking, yeah, well, if they call me out, if they want to sign, I'll sign. But at that point, I was like, I'm done. I'm done with that. I didn't even care.
That's understandable. I mean, you've gone through a lot in that period of time since initially being drafted by Portland and, you know, almost 10 years on. They should have known, I guess, what you could bring to the table each time that you were playing the game. Did you ever entertain or receive any offers to play over in Europe at that stage?
Yeah, I did. I did get one offer to go somewhere overseas. But at the time, you know, I got married and I had a son, and I was just like, look, nah, I'm done. He was like 2 months old. And I was like, I think I need to be here for my son. You know, I'm not going to make any real money, but I just decided, look, this is it.
Yeah. Basketball Digest, they had a regular feature back in the day that was titled The Game I'll Never Forget. And they'd ask a player to talk about a game from their career at any level, really, that comes to mind. Do you have a particular game? You did mention one against Marquette when you were playing back in college, but is there any other particular game that springs to mind there, Clay?
Well, the one that really springs to my mind, is it'll be my last college game, the one that we did go to double overtime. It sticks in my mind because one of the guys on Utah's team, Buster Matheny, we ended up being real good friends. And, you know, we played in Salt Lake City together because he went to the University of Utah and is right there in Salt Lake City. So we ended up being really good friends from that. And then actually I called his mother, my mother. We were like brothers. We ended up being like brothers. And he ended up getting killed in Los Angeles by some gang members. They robbed him and they ended up shooting him back in the head.
Oh, wow.
So that game really sticks out in my mind because of, you know, the relationships that you build, that you find and you build by playing basketball. Basketball is a really great vehicle, you know, to meet people and just relationships, because he became a brother of mine. And I still talk to his younger brother. Actually, now his younger brother is the only one living in his family. Buster got killed. His brother, Ricky, died of a heart attack. His mother passed away and his father passed away. So Tony's the only one living now. And he calls me all the time, big brother. He called me big brother. That game, that's really kind of like end up being a part of my life.
Really well said. And I'm terribly sorry to hear that, of course. It goes without saying, I guess. But it is great to see that the ties that bind can obviously last a lot longer than the game itself that you're talking about. So that's important to note as well. Just a couple more quick questions, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
On a much lighter note, you wore jersey number 34 when you were in the NBA, and I think you might have wore number 32 at Missouri.
Yeah.
Did you have any particular significance to either of those numbers?
Well, 32 was just in Penn Valley, my number was 30.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to Mizzou, Willie Smith had number 30, and they had retired that number. So the next number was 32. And then when I got drafted by Portland, Bill Walton,
of course.
So there was no way I can get number 32. So the next number was 34. And that's why I end up wearing number 34 with the Lakers and with Seattle.
Okay, very good. I always like to ask if there is any particular significance behind the numbers, and sometimes the stories behind them are very interesting in themselves. The last thing I'd like to quickly chat about, in 2004, I believe was the year, you established the Clay Johnson Foundation, which has a focus on the youth of the greater Kansas City area, from what I understand. Can you talk about the foundation and in the last, you know, 10, 11 years, the obvious importance that it has in your life and those of many of the youth around your area?
Well, you know, growing up in Kansas City, I grew up in the housing projects, the low income, at risk area. That's where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
I got out of there to go back, and you see the kids, they don't think that there's a chance for them to get out. And I just go back and I let them know that it's possible. I was you guys that's sitting here looking around on the playgrounds. I was you guys. And if I did it, you can do it. And then I just try to put some type of hope into their life. Let them know, like, somebody cares. Somebody did it. And you can do it. That's the main message I want to give to the youth. And now I do that everywhere I go. Not so much just here in Kansas City, everywhere I go. And it's funny that, you know, it's been, I don't know how many years since I played with the Lakers, but it holds so much value to it. Clay Johnson, former Los Angeles Laker, world championship, and that carries so much weight. It's like, you know, it's like I just played with the Lakers last year. Lakers haven't won championship in years, but you know, that fact that I played for the Lakers and my first major fundraiser that I had here in Kansas City, Magic Johnson came back. He came back to Kansas City and was my guest of honor.
Oh, fantastic.
figure of all this stuff that he has to do and his schedule, he came to Kansas City for little old me to help me out. He actually stayed 4 days, and he actually donated $25,000 to the foundation.
Wow.
To help us out.
That's excellent.
Just shows what kind of guy he is, you know?
That's fantastic. Fairly good to hear that sort of stuff. So you get to travel around America supporting and promoting the foundation?
Yes. I have a message that I want to give. I give all the kids. And I tell my little story about how I made it and how I didn't make it and how I got cut and the persistence that I had and, you know, the hard work that I put in, and let them know that, you know, it's possible. It's possible for them to do the same thing, but it's going to take a lot of hard work. It takes a lot of hard work, but just don't give up. Don't give up.
I think the word persistence has been an overarching theme in our conversation today, and it's a very apt description of what you went through to make it to the highest level and also to become an NBA champion. So great stuff. Congratulations on that, and also what you're doing with your foundation now.
And the one thing I want to say in ending is I was never a superstar in the NBA, not even close to being a star. But now, from, you know, the life that I live, I have some of the former superstars. They look up to me for, I guess, the work that I do and just the persistence that I had. And I still have the same persistence. I feel like I can do anything in this world, in this life that I want to do. I feel like I can do it.
And that's a great attitude to have. And that's one of the reasons why I love chatting with players who aren't the so-called superstars and stars of the league from back in this era, because I just love the history of the game, and I love just looking through rosters of players and looking at names and wondering what they're up to these days. So that's part of the appeal of why I even create this podcast. I just love to see what people are up to these days, some 10, 20, 30 years on from their pro careers. So you're a perfect example of that.
One thing that I want to say, I am a very spiritual person, which was, I think, the real reason behind me getting called up to the Lakers. I had a roommate in Montana. His name was Lowe's Moore, and he would always question me. I was like really competitive, and I used to curse a lot, use a lot of profanity, you know, as I play. He told me to watch what I say, you know, try to curve my conversation, my words. I didn't think I could do it. And I start saying darn instead of damn. And when I miss a layup or when something happened, you know, I would say shoot, you know. And he ended up getting picked up by the Clippers. He was my roommate the same year I got picked up by the Lakers. So he was my roommate. He left his Bible with me. And then I eventually studied and asked Christ into my life. I got born again. And I feel like that was the real reason behind me making it, getting picked up by the NBA and being so, I guess, so successful with the championship and, you know, my persistence and my patience. And this is like a reward for me for living. I was always a good person, but I, you know, turned to a godly person was the all the difference.
Faith plays a large part in a lot of athletes' lives, and that certainly did have a big impact on how your career turned out as well. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you today, Clay. Thanks very much for your time, and I wish you all the best going forwards.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. Suggest topics or guests you want to hear conversations with. You can leave a voicemail. Simply visit inallairness.com/voice. Click start recording, leave a message and press stop. You can even listen back before you submit. Press send and you're done. Time to share another excellent review from a fan of the show. This time, thanks to JCTCHI1980. Now, I get the CHI Chicago reference, but pretty sure that's not your real name. The review is on the USA iTunes store. It's titled Great Podcast, and it reads, I found this podcast randomly and cannot get enough. I've been listening to old ones and just listened to episode 8 with Peter Vesey and was extremely impressed with the candor that was charmed out of the guest. I am recommending this to my Hoops fans as it is great stuff. Thanks so much, JCT. That means a lot. And by telling your friends about it, that's the best way to help promote the show and actually help it rise up in the rankings and get found by even more fans. So thank you very much. Worldwide, the show currently has 56 reviews, 53 on iTunes and 3 on Stitcher. Thanks for your continued support. If you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. Your ratings and reviews are one of the best ways to support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please do tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Your word-of-mouth recommendations are definitely worth their weight in gold. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. iTunes, visit inallairness.com/review. Add it to your Stitcher playlist, inallairness.com/Stitcher. You can also subscribe on Pocket Casts, Player FM, TuneIn Radio, and other podcatchers. The show is always available through the podcast's app on your iOS device. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallairness.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high-profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at InAllAnus. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/InAllAnus. Join me next time for another edition of the show.